This is Point of Inquiry for Friday, February 24th, 2006.
Welcome to Point of Inquiry. I'm DJ Grothy. Point of Inquiry is the radio show and podcast of the Center for Inquiry, a think tank affiliated with the State University of New York at Buffalo, with branches in Manhattan, Tampa, and Hollywood. Every week on Point of Inquiry, we look at some of the most basic beliefs of our culture, focusing on three research areas. First, pseudoscience and the paranormal. Second, we look at what's called alternative medicine. And third, on Point of Inquiry, we concentrate on the intersection of religion and science in our society, on issues surrounding secularism and humanism and non-belief. We do this by drawing on the Center for Inquiry's relationship with the leading minds of the day, including Nobel Prize-winning scientists, public intellectuals, social critics and thinkers, and renowned entertainers. On today's episode of Point of Inquiry, we will be joined by Dr. Wallace Sampson of Stanford University, editor of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine. Later in the show, I'll talk with PsyCOP's senior research fellow, Joe Nickel, in the first of a two-part series on investigating the paranormal, ghost hunting to be specific, and Benjamin Radford will share his regular segment, Media Mythmakers. But first, Tom Flynn asks, did you know?
Did you know that the U.S. federal government's 2006 budget includes roughly $123 million for the study and promotion of alternative medicine? Did you know that the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, funded more than 1,200 projects at some 260 research institutions last year? Did you know that 62% of people in a recent survey of 31,000 Americans responded that they regularly use alternative medicine? Did you know that the heavily promoted alternative medicine combination of glucosamine and chondroitin is about as effective as a placebo for most people with arthritis, according to a major national study released this week, headed by a University of Utah researcher?
With all the endless promotion of herbal remedies and alternative therapies, acupuncture, aromatherapy, magnet therapy, therapeutic touch, homeopathy, naturopathy, all of these, how can the average consumer find objective scientific information evaluating these products and treatments? My guest today on Point of Inquiry, Dr. Wallace Sampson, is an expert on this sort of stuff. He serves as the editor of the Scientific Review of Alternative Medicine, and he's a member of the board of directors of the National Council Against Health Fraud. He served as chief of medical oncology at the Santa Clara Valley Medical Center and is clinical professor emeritus of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Sampson is an expert on unscientific medical systems and alternative medical claims and teaches the critical analysis of complementary and alternative medicine at Stanford University. He's co-editor of the book Science Meets Alternative Medicine. Welcome to Point of Inquiry, Dr. Sampson.
Thank you.
Dr. Sampson, a growing number of Americans are increasingly using what's called complementary and alternative medicine. Salesmen like Kevin Trudeau have their late-night infomercials and push millions of copies of their books touting non-medical cures for everything from high blood pressure and diabetes to cancer and heart disease. People report that these methods work not only better than scientific methods, or what's called evidence-based medicine, but that scientific medicine is actually bad for patients. You're here today to help us get into this subject, so why don't we begin by having you define complementary and alternative medicine?
Complementary and alternative are two terms that are really recent inventions. They are actually slogans for marketing. They didn't exist 25 years ago. The predecessor was holistic medicine. Proponents of holistic medicine wanted to change the face of medicine as well as its substance into making it more human, spiritual, and magical, if you will. and to reincorporate these principles that had been actually dissected away with the Age of Enlightenment. In other words, the rise of science depended on everyone dissecting away personal views, religious views, magical views, spirituality, and those kinds of subjective aspects of human nature. So that's the success of science. That's where medicine has arrived in the 20th, the late 20th century. The alternative people saw that this is an opportunity to capitalize on the holistic movement and to regain legitimacy for what was essentially called quackery, and which in 1911 and thereabouts was also formally excised from the scientific medical community. So it really is, it's a slogan, a marketing term to reincorporate what we were calling quackery up until about 25 years ago.
Sounds a little like intelligent design being the renaming of creationism.
Well, it's exactly the same thing. And of course, it goes on in life all the time. Politics is full of this kind of thing, these sloganeering statements to sell an idea. And they all have to be put in acceptable terms. So depending on the audience you speak to, you tailor the term or the slogan and hope that it sells. And they've been fairly successful.
Well, the term quackery seems to bring to my mind fraud or just out-and-out huckstering. Alternative medicine, complementary medicine, seems to bring to my mind these nicer feelings that they aren't anti-health. They're just maybe alongside traditional medicine. What's the difference between complementary medicine and alternative medicine, or is there?
It's in the wording. There's no difference in the reality. There's no difference in what science has to say about whether things work or not. It's in the words that one describes, and that's exactly what the problem is. It is essentially a postmodern maneuver in which you change people's perceptions by changing language. That's what a lot of what Derrida and sometimes Foucault and some others of the postmodernist philosophies had to say. That's what they claimed could be done and was reality. They could change reality by changing the language. So they said, and that's what they have done.
So you're saying complementary medicine, alternative medicine, they're the same thing. What's integrative medicine?
It's another slogan, and it was invented, I believe, by Andrew Weil in Arizona in order to bypass entirely the scientific method and rational thinking. Integrative means you do it anyway, even when there is no evidence that it works, or there is evidence that it doesn't work. You do it anyway. So that's called integrating or integrative medicine. Rather than doing it instead of or doing it in addition to, you actually rename the thing so that science and proof become irrelevant. It doesn't matter whether you prove it or not. You just do it anyway.
I'd like to let our listeners know that you can receive a discounted copy of Dr. Sampson's book, Science Meets Alternative Medicine, on our website, pointofinquiry.org. Dr. Sampson, the number of Americans seeking complementary and alternative medicine, it seems to be increasing. Is that true? Are more and more people using it?
No, as a matter of fact, that's another marketing ploy. the way they got the statistic to show it was increasing by adding in a number of methods that people use on their own that have been in use, you know, for centuries. They included prayer, formal exercise, weight reduction clinics, and things like that in their definition of alternative medicine, and suddenly found that 34%, now 44% of people were using it within a period of 1 year. Actually, in 1900 to 1910, close to 100% of people did that because there was so little in the way of scientific medicine. In 1977, a Roper poll showed 27% were using it. And from 27% to 34% is not very large, especially when you change the wording of the question.
Okay, so we've defined alternative medicine, and you're saying that it's not exponentially growing in the numbers of people who are using it. We've defined alternative medicine. Why don't you define for me what scientific medicine is? It seems like a simple question, but when someone out there is saying this is medical, how do you know it's medical? How do you know it's medicine?
Yeah, that's a very good and basic question, which many people can't answer. Now, science, of course, is a human endeavor, and so it's full of faults. Let me introduce it with that. And to get to the heart of a matter of something real, a real cause and a real treatment that really works, there are lots of errors that are made along the way. But our job is to find out what those errors are and to correct them. That's what scientific medicine is. So the way it works today is that a certain number of people do what's called epidemiologic studies, or they take a look at a section of the world, of the population, and see whether a disorder is there or not, or behavior is there, and so forth, and compare it to another section in another part of the world, or in the same part of the world with a different population. And that's called a cross-sectional study, that's epidemiology, and that's the first way you find out whether there's something worthwhile there to study. Either there's a difference between those two groups, or there isn't. If there's no difference, you drop it. And if there is a difference, you go on and you do what's called a clinical trial. And you put people on the one, or in observation, in one condition, and then just observe a normal control population without doing anything, or give them some other method, and you compare them. And then you analyze them statistically. But the whole thing depends that you've made an accurate evaluation in the first place. In other words, you can't just study anything. You want to study the relationship of small dogs to large dogs and see if there's a major difference in their reproductive rates or something like that. That's not worthwhile to study because we know that dogs are species, they've been bred and they can interbreed and so forth. And what useful information would come of that? But that's the kind of study that's being done in alternative and complementary medicine. They're taking implausible propositions or things that we know already don't work because we've studied them in various other ways, and then they're applying clinical trials. And there are hundreds of millions of dollars every year being spent on these, and careers are being made on this. This is pseudoscience.
So the 2006 budget, we heard earlier in the show before your interview began, Dr. Sampson, that the U.S. federal government's 2006 budget includes roughly $123 million for the study of and the promotion of alternative medicine. And I take it you're saying this is a waste of money.
Well, of course. They can claim that it isn't a waste of money because they're finding out certain things that don't work. For instance, recently they've shown that echinacea doesn't work, and now this past week they've shown that glucosamine and chondroitin don't work for osteoarthritis. So there is some value in showing these things don't work, but we knew they wouldn't work in the first place. And the problem is they won't call any of us in to explain why these things probably won't work, why they're wasting the money.
You were talking about scientific medicine earlier, and now about how alternative medicine is so hit and miss, and you know it won't work from the beginning, but isn't it the same in medicine? Isn't medicine sometimes just hit and miss? Don't we sometimes just serendipitously figure out that, oh, this thing cures that in medicine?
Yeah, well, there's a difference in what's being proposed here. There's hit and miss, which means complete random studying of something, if you know what I mean, just randomly selecting something to study. And there's a difference between that and studying something where you've made an observation and you want to see whether it's true or not. Those are two different things. Those are not hit and miss. And most of medicine, of course, all good medicine, the medical science, is advanced along with the rest of science by using accurate observation, insightful observation. In other words, we've been preceded by not a bunch of ignoramuses. We've been preceded by geniuses, people who developed anatomy, the dissection of the human body, the discovery of physiology, discovery of plant extracts of various sorts that treat certain conditions. These were very astute people who made these observations and went ahead and proved them. These were not random observations. These were not taking something like a sweet pea in the garden and finding out if you can cure cancer with it. You don't do that. What you do is you take all the information you have at hand in the first place, and you study the things that seem to have some validity to them. You can't study everything or every relationship that there is in the world. There's an infinite number of relationships between things.
It seems like there are a lot of people getting involved in alternative medicine these days, not just alternative medicine practitioners. Even the televangelist Pat Robertson is now selling something called Queen's Jelly, which is the food that worker bees produce for the queen bee in a hive, and he says that it has miraculous healing powers, that Queen's Jelly lets the queen bee live for 6 years instead of 6 weeks, which is how long worker bees live. Then he argues that the same substance can have similar effects if people eat it. That's just one, I think, silly example. Can you give me some other examples of alternative medicine therapies that people use?
Well, pick one. Pick anyone. Chiropractic, based on an equally erroneous observation that a grocer cracked his janitor's neck, and the janitor claimed that he could hear right afterwards. That had no basis in anatomy or rationality of any kind at the time. And, even medicine experts knew that at the time.
And now it's being tightly regulated in Canada, where chiropractic has been shown to cause death in some people?
Well, sure. The same maneuver, which was manipulation of the neck, has been caused death and paralysis by stroke, and also by local transection of the spinal cord in the neck. Both of those things happen. And we've known that for decades. If you go back in the literature, there are hundreds of cases described dating back into the 1930s of that. And still it goes on.
What are the most harmful examples of alternative medicine, in your opinion?
Well, that's hard to say, because it isn't so much the method as it is the people doing it. And there's a rogues gallery of charlatans who do these things, but there are also people in medical schools who actually believe these things. They head up departments. You have deans of medical schools. As a matter of fact, the Council of Deans of the Association of American Medical Colleges had prominent alternativists give talks to them in the year 2000, and they've never invited the skeptics or the people who really know what's going on to give the same kind of talk. In other words, they're all, well, let me put it this way. This whole system is a social, socially generated brainwash. This is what it is. It's a social change. Books are written about this. One of the originals was Robert McKay's classical book, written in 1850, extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds. He described stock market bubbles, land buying bubbles, the tulip mania in Holland, all sorts of big social delusional movements. You could go on and into politics, Nazism, communism. All these kinds of things where masses of people start to believe things that aren't true.
And you're saying alternative medicine is one of those things?
Well, it's probably, in terms of dollars, it's probably the most massive delusion, social delusion, ever. Although, it's hard to say what was communism, what was not communism. But the capability of people to be deluded because of social pressures and claims is quite remarkable. I mean, how do you count for 20 million people being murdered in World War II that way over what? What the hell are they fighting over? It's been a hell of a lot. Everybody would have been better off if it hadn't happened. And take a look at today, what's going on in the Middle East, what goes on in China. These are major political movements that depend on people believing what they're told.
Believing things that are untrue, you're arguing.
The belief things that are untrue.
You mentioned the profit motive a moment ago, or if you didn't mention the profit motive, you mentioned money. Now I'll ask you a question about the profit motive. I've heard the argument that scientific medicine, call it evidence-based medicine, if that's your point of view, that those kinds of doctors resist the growing alternative medicine movement because it's kind of cutting in on their action. The large pharmaceutical companies, Big Pharma as it's called, resist the herbal supplement movement because it's a multi-million dollar industry. What do you say about that charge that oh, you skeptics, you have vested interest, you don't want your action being cut in on?
Well, this sort of taking the obvious and running with it and making a false statement on it. It's not quite a straw man argument because there's an element of truth to it. Of course, scientific doctors don't want their careers ruined by alternative things that don't work. So it's a partly true statement, but carried to an ridiculous extreme. In fact, there has been no impact of the alternative medicine movement on the income of physicians that we know of, anyway. The major impact has been that of control of, by the central government, by the federal government over Medicare fees and so forth, but not because of alternative medicine. So this has no basis, although the argument appeals, and there's always some validity to the feeling that that might happen.
What do you think about the notion about Big Pharma being threatened by the multi-million dollar herbal supplement movement?
To the contrary, most of Big Pharma has been buying up the smaller supplement companies and marketing, responsible for the marketing. The marketing of vitamin C, which is still number two or three on the list of popularity after 20 or 30 years of being number one, is most of it's made by Burroughs Wellcome in England, where they've made fortunes on vitamin C. These things are big business. These are not small operations.
I'd like to remind our listeners that you can get a discounted copy of Dr. Sampson's book, Science Meets Alternative Medicine, on our website, pointofinquiry.org. I'd like to get back to herbal remedies for a moment. You can go into any drugstore now and see a whole shelf of herbal remedies, even though it's a pharmacy. Those I talk to about this say that herbal remedies aren't backed by clinical trials. But isn't there a lot of wisdom to be gained from folk traditions? I mean, isn't that how we learned about things like quinine?
Yes, it is. And as a matter of fact, quinine is not the only one. It's been estimated that somewhere up to perhaps 50% of the modern drugs we use have their origins in empirical observation of plants and their extracts on various disorders in history. But there's a difference here. On the one hand, we have an observation made and repeated, and after repeated observations, knowing that then that there's a high likelihood that there's something working, then going ahead and extracting that active principle and purifying it in a scientific way, that's called pharmacology, testing it further on animals and testing it in humans, arriving at the right dosage, testing it on a number of different conditions, and knowing which ones for which it'll work, which it won't. And that's called pharmacology and clinical trials and science. That's medical science. Now, there's a big difference between that and making one empirical observation in history, writing it down and telling everybody about it, and then it becoming a folk tradition with no evidence and no science behind it, no organized observation, no way of testing it in an organized fashion, and then going ahead and marketing it in a health food store or in a pharmacy. That is false. That's simply false promotion. And there are laws against things like that in other fields. But because of the popularity and the social movements that have been going on in alternative medicine, they can get away with it.
So you're saying herbal remedies are not backed by clinical trials?
Probably none of them work. When I say that, you take the top 10 sellers and you take a look and see what they're promoted for, and you can't find any really good reason for why they're being promoted. They really don't work.
Even if this or that herbal remedy doesn't actually work, doesn't actually provide any positive medicinal effect, doesn't it at least provide hope, mere hope that the patient will improve? Doesn't hope in and of itself have a healing effect? I guess what I'm talking about here is the benefits of the placebo effect.
Yeah, well, you have to back up a minute. Hope is the source of the success of all con artists. Let's start with that and then talk about things like healing, which have no meaning, really. Anything that really heals means it's something that you can measure that gets better than doing nothing, or better than a placebo. So if that can't be demonstrated, then you have a false claim. It's a con. It's equivalent to a con. Second, is there such a thing as a placebo effect? And I think we're pretty much all assured now that what is called a placebo effect is a mixture of any one of 16 different psychological mechanisms that have been investigated by cognitive psychologists for decades. And they're all written down in their books, and they're all in journals, well outlined, but it's just that someone hasn't taken the trouble to look them up and apply them to medicine. Now, I shouldn't say no one has, because several people have actually done that, but they're ignored. As a matter of fact, there are two alternativists who published this material in an alternative medicine journal about 10 years ago, and nobody paid attention. We did. One of our authors, Barry Beierstein, wrote a highly effective article for our journal commenting on that particular paper. And there have been others who've mentioned the fact, and then there's this Danish group who looked into all the papers comparing various methods to placebos and to nothing, and found that there was no difference between giving a placebo and doing nothing. And that paper was published in the New England Journal of Medicine about 3 years ago, quite famous. So right at the present time, we have no evidence that there's such a thing as a real placebo effect.
Dr. Sampson, we've discussed alternative medicine, its problems, some solutions that you've proposed. What should our listeners do if they're interested in learning more about alternative medicine, or especially if they're alarmed by some of the trends in alternative medicine that you've talked about? What can they do to make a difference?
It's very difficult to say. We wonder if all the work that we've put into the study of this system in the past 30 years has made a difference. Maybe a little bit, because we're expanding our knowledge of how these things work as social delusions, and learning more ourselves about scientific method, what we can trust and what we can't. We haven't gone into that much, but that's a whole other field to explore, why some of our scientific clinical trials turn out positive, and there's a reason for that, when there is no positivity there. But I think it's a difficult thing to study now, because we haven't formalized all of our observations in a digestible form. I think a good place to start might be that book, Science Meets Alternative Medicine, although it's now going on 10 years old. Much of the stuff is still applicable and valid. Take a look at quackwatch.com, run by Stephen Barrett, and developed by Stephen Barrett. It has all the information you need to know on every alternative method, and with all the warnings and all the side effects and all the things you want to know to avoid.
Dr. Sampson, friend of mine who's kind of invested in the alternative medicine movement, when mentioning that site, quackwatch.org, says, well, that's just a front for big pharmacy or for these medical organizations. Of course they want to discredit alternative medicine because they have vested interests. What do you say to that?
Well, of course, Quackwatch receives no funding or other help from any organization, whether pharmacy or medical at all. It's a completely independent organization. And your friend who believes this is simply believing another promotional slogan and lie. I hate to put it that way because it sounds so negative, but that's what it is. It's a falsehood.
Dr. Sampson, thank you for being on Point of Inquiry.
You're quite welcome.
Get active with the Center for Inquiry and join our growing network of activists who work with us to promote science and reason across America. Participate in action alerts, letter writing campaigns, and stay up to date on Center for Inquiry events happening in your community and across the country. To join, visit our website at www.pointofinquiry.org and click Get Active.
Hi, I'm Barry Carr, Executive Director of PSYCOP here at the Center for Inquiry. We're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year, making the world safe for science and skepticism and dealing with fringe science and paranormal claims. We publish what I think is an essential magazine, The Skeptical Inquirer. This is the magazine for science and reason. The March-April issue is now on the bookshelves and can be ordered online at www.psycop.org or by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-634-1610. Subscribing to The Skeptical Inquirer helps us continue to advance science and reason in our society. And I'm so sure that you'll love this magazine that I want you to have a complimentary issue to see what we're all about. To get your sample copy of The Skeptical Inquirer, just call 1-800-634-1610 and mention the Point of Inquiry podcast and ask us for your free copy. We'll get it right out to you and you can begin enjoying The Skeptical Inquirer. Thank you.
You are listening to Point of Inquiry. Email questions and comments to feedback@pointofinquiry.org.
Now, Point of Inquiry contributor Benjamin Radford talks to us about labyrinths.
Over the past decade, across the country and around the world, a new facet of the New Age movement has been quietly taking hold. It is the phenomenon of labyrinths, single-path, maze-like patterns. Unlike a maze, a person can't get lost in a labyrinth. There's only one path in and out. The labyrinth is an ancient symbol, and though its exact origins are murky, it has found a New Age revival in the past decade, due mostly to a book called Walking the Sacred Path by Lauren Artress. Many people use labyrinths as tools for meditations or psychotherapy, especially as an aid for resolving personal issues. Those seeking answers to life's questions are encouraged to work out their issues on the labyrinth. Often, walkers focus on issues as they approach the center, confront the problems at the center, and resolve them on the way out. But is this any more effective than just taking a walk? For such a supposedly powerful tool, there has been very little written about labyrinth therapy in medical journals. One of the few articles appeared in the Annals of the American Psychotherapy Association. The piece, titled Off the Couch, An Introduction to Labyrinths and Their Therapeutic Properties, is not a study or survey, but simply a short review of the topic by psychologist Neil Harris. Harris has used the labyrinth in his practice as a, quote, vehicle for assisting mental focus, group cohesion, and spiritual connection. Harris cites the work of psychiatrist Dr. Wayne London that suggests a short-term increase in mental clarity in some people with Alzheimer's, schizophrenia, and dyslexia after following a labyrinth with their fingers. Harris admits that the research is anecdotal and that any long-term effects have not been studied. The article states that Harris himself has invented a wooden finger labyrinth to be used with clients. He calls it the therapist board. And the article concludes on a strangely commercial note. It says, quote, "Discover for yourself why many throughout the world consider a labyrinth to be sacred space, a locale where the physical and the esoteric worlds meet. I encourage therapists to begin to utilize finger labyrinths, especially the therapist board, in their practices," end quote. Harris then goes on to provide a telephone number and web address for orders. The research that Harris cites, it turns out, was not published in any respected peer-reviewed medical journal, but instead comes from Dr. London's 1998 alternative medicine book, The Spiritual and Healing Aspects of the Classical Seven-Path Labyrinth. Dr. London has continued studying the benefits of labyrinth therapy, working with Judith M. Joyce, Vice President of the Labyrinth Society. Their collaboration explores not only neurological disorders, but, they say, quote, "the healing effects of the labyrinth on the land," end quote. Now, how exactly the soil, rocks, and trees surrounding the labyrinth are healed is left unexplained. Some promoters claim that the labyrinth has healing powers beyond the psychological. Some people claim to have been cured of serious diseases by walks in labyrinths, though to what degree that's attributable to placebo effects or religious fervor is hard to determine. Artress admits that the evidence that labyrinths can heal physical diseases is shaky. The Carbondale Labyrinth Project 2000 in southern Illinois recommends their labyrinth for, quote, "persons with head injuries or learning disabilities who might use it to facilitate sensory integration." Many medical programs have incorporated labyrinths. The first medical facility to install a labyrinth on its grounds was San Francisco's Pacific Medical Center. Other hospitals have installed labyrinths, including St. Vincent Jennings Hospital in North Vernon, Indiana, and St. Luke's Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. In fact, one labyrinth resource, the Labyrinth Project, lists nearly 100 labyrinths at hospitals and healthcare facilities in 26 states and several foreign countries. Some labyrinth advocates, including educator Judy Bryan, who's the former director of the children's program at Maryland Soderle Plantation, believe that the seven-circuit shape of the labyrinth may somehow help to enhance children's learning capacities, including those with ADD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. O'Brien planned to design experiments in which elementary school children walk labyrinths and then test their reading and comprehension skills before and after. Though her tests were to have begun in the year 2000, so far O'Brien has not released her results, if any. I tried to contact O'Brien about it, but she didn't respond to repeated requests for interviews. Proponents admit that the mechanism by which labyrinths supposedly heal is unknown. Artress, the guru of the modern movement, says that, quote, "We do not really know why or how the labyrinth works. Yet, depending on what exactly the claim is, we do in fact know why labyrinths work. It's clear that labyrinths can have a meditating and calming effect. Just about any action done with the intention of relaxing will be relaxing. In this regard, the labyrinth is just one of many meditation devices and techniques, all of which are just as nurturing and relaxing as you make it. There's no evidence, however, that the labyrinth is any more therapeutic or effective than, say, meditation, tai chi, or just taking a leisurely walk. Think about it."
Science and reason are increasingly under assault in our society, even at our leading colleges and universities. If you are a student, faculty, or staff member, we invite you to join Center for Inquiry on campus. Every semester, the Center for Inquiry sponsors dozens of lectures, debates, and panel discussions on college campuses across North America, in addition to providing free educational and promotional materials so that students can work with us to promote science and reason at their schools. To join, visit www.campusinquirer.org.
You are listening to Point of Inquiry. Visit us online at pointofinquiry.org.
I'm pleased to have back in the studio Dr. Joe Nickel, the world's leading paranormal investigator. Using his varied background, he's become widely known as an investigator of myths and mysteries, frauds, forgeries, and hoaxes. He's been called the modern-day Sherlock Holmes, the original Ghostbuster, and the real-life Scully after that character in X-Files, The Skeptic. If you like TV documentaries on the Discovery Channel, Court TV, Science Channel, etc., you will know Joe Nickel since he is the person who's always given the last 5 minutes on one of the shows dealing with the paranormal. He gives the skeptical scientific point of view on these shows dealing with psychics or ghosts or UFOs or Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, etc. A veteran of literally hundreds of these TV appearances, he's the author of over 20 books, including Inquest on the Shroud of Turin, Secrets of the Supernatural, Looking for a Miracle, Entities, Psychic Sleuths, Real Life X-Files, The Mystery Chronicles, and on and on. He's on Point of Inquiry today for the first of a two-part series on investigating ghosts. Welcome to Point of Inquiry again, Joe.
Thanks, DJ. It's good to be here and good to have another chance to, make the record straight that I'm not a debunker, but an investigator, and it's good to be at a place that appreciates that.
Well, let's concentrate today on, not to editorialize too much, but the pseudoscientific methods of investigating.
The wrong approach.
Okay. First of all, let's just ask, how old is the search for ghosts? How long have people actually been looking into this?
You know, we really don't actually know because I think the answer is shrouded in the mists of time. I think that humankind has believed in spirits of the dead since the most ancient time, and that belief is in all cultures, that something happens to the dead, that there's not a finality, but that somehow the spirit goes somewhere, and that we might be able to tap that other world somehow. And so one of the oldest mentions of any such thing is in the Old Testament when the witch of Endor conjures up the ghost of Samuel. And that's really the beginning of spiritualism. I mean, historically, that's one of the early mentions of that being done, the contact with spirits of the dead. Now, it's not really an investigation, but it's having a sensitive person, a medium, contact that world so that it sets up the idea that someone can interact, that people can contact ghosts, that they're real, and that they can be contacted.
Right. If I remember the Old Testament right, the Hebrew Bible, the account wasn't really treated very skeptically. It was considered a bad thing to do, but it wasn't suspected.
That's right. That's exactly right. That it wasn't dismissed as not being true, or if
it was just bad.
Would be our view today would sinful. Be, oh, you think you can call up spirits? Well, we would question whether you really can. But if you could, we probably would be for it, as opposed to it being an evil thing,
right.
and you know, the work of the devil or something. Then the first instance of something that we might think of as sort of a paranormal type investigation was a philosopher named Athenodorus, and this is probably about A.D. 1 or somewhere along there. It's not dated. We have the story from Pliny the Younger 100 years later. So we're looking back at this case, and of course, in 100 years, we can imagine that the story has gotten quite exaggerated. But the idea is that he bought a house, and he tries to ignore the fact that it's supposedly been haunted and so forth until the spirit actually shows up, clanking chains and so forth, and beckons to him, and he follows it out into the garden, and whereupon at a certain spot it disappears. So the next day, he has the officials dig at the spot, and they dig up a skeleton in chains. And so you see, you really are ghosts then. The story proves it and so forth. Well, who knows how that story really started. It's a folk tale by the time we got it. And it's very dated. You and I have talked on other occasions about sort of iconography of things, how things develop. And there's interesting iconography with ghosts that each age invents ghosts in its own image or its own way. For example, in Shakespeare's times, there were ghosts crying out for revenge for their foul murder and maybe clanking chains and that sort of thing. In the Victorian era, ghosts were these silent, gliding gray ladies that just sort of glided through the haunted mansions, calling attention to themselves. And today, ghosts are mischief makers, or they show up in photographs in odd ways or whatever.
Or they're spirits of deceased family
right,
members.
Who contact us. And even if you look at the spiritualist kind of things, I remember I have some antique trance writings of a medium, and I'll just have to make one up, but they go something like this. Oh, my darling brother, it has been so long since we have communicated through the misty veils of time and through the wonderful mediumship of Mrs. So-and-so and so forth. And they're just loquacious, and they go on in this rhetorical style and so forth. And then today we have John Edward and these guys that claim to talk to the dead. And I'm getting a J-sounding name, like maybe J. The dead are apparently now, they've lost their memory, they stammer,
they give hints.
Right. They know so little, and certainly all the rhetoric and eloquence is gone. Well, I'm getting on to another subject here.
So the whole process of investigating ghosts, in some form or another, reaches back through the whole history of the Western cultural tradition. Let me ask you about today. How does someone today go about searching for a ghost?
No one knows. Well, actually, maybe I do, but how do we count the ways? The one way is people simply show up at a haunted house and ask, tell me your story. And that's almost an end point. They're collecting tales.
Right.
There are books full of these. Various ghost hunters who go and they write these in breathless fashion. And it is said that at midnight on the, you know, a certain date, the spirit of the, and they're written in this kind of G-golly style. And they're often based on what somebody has told them, and oftentimes even hearsay. And they're just repeating folk tales in some cases, or they're telling their personal experiences, but they're being assessed uncritically. They're
right.
Just being written down as these are true stories of what actually happened.
Not as an investigation. It's just a compiling of accounts.
And yet, some of the people doing the collecting of stories, because they've gone there and walked through the house and talked to the person and so forth, they call it an investigation. But when you say to them, well, so how many cases have you solved? They don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean solved? Well, the presumption is that if you have a case and you're an investigator, you solve something, meaning you explain it. And they're not explaining much. They're just collecting allegations of ghosts and maybe saying, maybe by implication, well, I have so many such tales and they're similar pattern, that must be proof in itself. Another method, which we saw in the Roman case at the beginning of the first millennium is what we might call the psychic method. That is, a sensitive person witnesses the ghost, and the ghost then maybe tells them something, or somehow the psychic is able to verify that, yes, maybe the psychic says, oh, I see this figure, and then when we check the historical record, we find there was just such a figure, and they died under just such circumstances, and that proves not only that ghosts exist, but they're communicating to psychics and so forth. The problem is that there are really no real tests of any psychic. No one's been found to have psychic powers, and in many of these cases, the psychic could have gone and looked up some material in the library and come and revealed it, or they could have picked up cues, or there could be some other problem with the evidence.
So that kind of experience is hardly an investigation. It's more like a psychic revelation. But, you know, there are people out there, there are shows on TV, I've watched them, where people are purporting to actually scientifically investigate a ghost scene. They have gizmos, they have scientific equipment, they go in and there's beeping and lights, and they're really picking up stuff. What about those kind of people, those ghost hunters?
Well, that method is often used in conjunction with psychics. Okay. Quite often they have a ghost club, and they may have one or two persons who fancy that they're psychic, and they go with them. And so when the psychic says at a certain place, I feel something happening at this spot, in rushes the more scientific types, right, with their ghost, right, meters, and they get readings, and the needle is wavering and so forth. Nearly every town and village now has a ghost club like this. I mean, they've proliferated in the last several years. They're everywhere. And the problem is that very rarely is any scientist associated with them. These people are not scientists. They are hobbyists. They have started with the idea that ghosts exist, that somehow they can test for ghosts by using scientific equipment, but they're not trained to use the equipment. They really could not actually tell you what the equipment actually does measure. They use these electromagnetic detection meters. And of course, those meters are not made to detect ghosts.
So they're misusing real scientific equipment.
They're using scientific equipment, but they're applying it to a purpose for which it was not intended. Much as a guy named Cleve Baxter years ago started the whole idea that plants have emotions, because he hooked up lie detectors to plants and got the needles to move. And it was probably measuring something like moisture absorption or something was affecting the galvanometer. But he took it that plants have emotions, and we started having this whole idea of talking to your plants and this whole new agey kind of thing based on pseudoscience. And this is pseudoscience. In fact, there are other things that cause these gizmos to go off, and that's what they're sold to detect. They might, for example, be responding to a faulty wiring. There might be microwave radiation or any of a number of other things that only if you could absolutely conclusively rule out every one of those might you then suggest that they were some kind of ghost energy. But these are never ruled out because they don't even mention them or have any means to rule them out. They don't know what they're doing, in other words. They're not scientists, and they shouldn't be using scientific equipment for a purpose for which it is not intended. And the same goes with some of the other equipment they're using. You know, they're using tape recorders to get whispered messages of ghosts.
Right, white noise and all that
and
stuff.
And in fact, that's what it is when you listen to the white noise, your imagination can run free, and you can imagine in the random patterns that you heard something.
Well, our noggins are meaning-making mechanisms. You hear something that sounds like something else, you make sense out of it.
That's
right. We have that capacity. It's good.
We do. It's just like when we look at random stains and we see that it looks like the face of Christ or something.
Right.
So we have visual and auditory means of doing that, a sort of Rorschach effect. But no matter what the equipment is that they're taking, I mean, they may be using infrared cameras. They're getting these misty patterns, but infrared sensitive to heat. They may be only getting a little warm current or something. And, of course, cameras are used big time because they're cheap and efficient and visual, and you can grab a ghost image on the cheap. And all of this approach is made to look scientific, and it's fundamentally not science.
You were just talking about pseudoscientific methods. What do you mean by pseudoscientific methods? It's real scientific equipment.
We have a name for that which looks superficially like science, but fundamentally is not science. Okay. And that's what pseudoscience is. Okay. If it doesn't look anything even vaguely like science, we just have a mystic going in and getting feelings, we wouldn't call it pseudoscience. We just call it fantasy or something.
Okay.
But when something has the trappings of science, when people do a lot of maybe measuring or use scientific jargon like energy fields or any of the trappings of science, but who fundamentally are not scientists, not using the equipment in a scientific way, and you know, the fundamental problem with the ghost hunters is that they're pretty much starting with a belief in ghosts, and they're using the equipment to sort of confirm that. They're really not starting from a completely impartial view of, are there really ghosts at all?
You mentioned ghost photographs earlier. Seems to me that's pretty good evidence. These people are taking physical pictures, actual pictures of ghosts. How do you explain ghost photographs?
Can a photograph lie? Actually, it can. A photographer friend of mine used to say that every photograph's a work of fiction. When we look at the history of photography, we go back to the daguerreotype process. Daguerreotypes in 1839, and not a single daguerreotype, to my knowledge, ever showed, other than something staged for an effect or something. But it was never claimed that a daguerreotype had a ghost recorded on it. Ambrotypes followed, and ambrotypes had no ghosts. Then there were tintypes. Most people are familiar with tintypes from the Civil War period. Still no ghosts. Where were the ghosts? Why were they so shy that they didn't show up in these early photographic processes? Well, it was not until glass plate negatives made double exposures possible that ghosts decided to show up. And they showed up most profoundly in 1862 when a Boston spirit photographer named William H. Mumler began taking spirit photographs, and you would sit for the picture and spirits would appear over your shoulder or around you. He fooled ultimately Abraham Lincoln's widow with this and was a very noted spirit photographer until one day someone noticed that some of his spirit extras were still living Bostonians. And that was the end of Mumler's career. But it's interesting that if you look at, even just at a superficial level, you look at ghost photos of an earlier period, and they're transparent people. They look just like people, only they're sort of transparent-looking images. That's what we thought ghosts looked like, and that's the way they showed up. Today, we don't see much of that at all because people realize those are probably faked in some ways. They're double exposures or some kind of Photoshop technique. But what we're finding now are orbs and ectoplasmic streaks and things in photos.
Right. You see little streaks of light or dots of light glowing.
A big one is orbs, and these are big balls, round balls of light that are in a scene. And whenever you see those, invariably when you ask questions, people were taking those pictures using the little small flash cameras, digital or film cameras, and there are differences in the effect. But basically what's happening is that tiny particles of dust in the air close to the lens are bouncing the flash back. And these are not ghosts at all. In some cases, droplets of moisture will do it or other things. And these strands and streaks and other effects, quite often they are flash-related as well. For example, there are strands of ectoplasmic-like streaks, as they're called, that are simply the camera's wrist strap bouncing the flashback. Strands of someone with long hair that has wandered in front of the camera, a wandering fingertip, bugs, any of a number of things that can get in front of the camera and bounce the flashback. And not to say that all the effects are that simple. Some are caused by other things, but they're all, I just lump them together as glitches. And because we don't know what caused a particular glitch, you and I weren't there, and those circumstances may not be able to be duplicated ever again, shouldn't be expected to just look at a photograph and know what caused it. It's not a reasonable expectation, and therefore those photographs are not proof of very much of anything. And there's certainly, we can't use this argument from ignorance, a logical fallacy in which you say, I don't know what caused the glitch in the photo, therefore it was a ghost. No, that's not logical and that's not science.
Look forward to continuing talking about this the next episode. Thanks, Joe, for being on Point of Inquiry.
My pleasure.
You've seen the headlines. Paranormal goes primetime. Vatican hosts conference on intelligent design. More clinics to offer alternative medicine. Christian fundamentalism drives U.S. extremism. These stories sum up the immense challenge facing those of us who defend rational thinking, science, and secular values, what one advisor to the Bush administration dismissed as the reality-based community. Who could have imagined that reality would need defenders? The educational and advocacy work of the Center for Inquiry is more essential than ever, and your support is more essential than ever. Show your commitment to science, reason, and secular values by becoming a friend of the Center today. Whether you are interested in the work of PsyCop and Skeptical Inquirer magazine, the Council for Secular Humanism and Free Inquiry magazine, the Commission for Scientific Medicine, or Center for Inquiry on Campus, by becoming a friend of the Center, you'll help strengthen our impact. If you are just learning about CFI, take a look at our website, www.centerforinquiry.net. We host regional and international conferences, offer college courses, and conduct nationwide campus outreach. On our website, you'll also find information regarding our new representation at the United Nations and important national media appearances. We could not pursue these projects without your support. Please become a friend of the Center today by calling 1-800-818-7071 or visiting www.centerforinquiry.net. We look forward to working with you to expand our reality-based community.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Point of Inquiry. Join us next week to hear my discussion with Daniel Dennett about his new book, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. Views expressed on Point of Inquiry do not necessarily reflect the views of the Center for Inquiry nor its affiliated organizations. Questions and comments on today's show can be sent to feedback@pointofinquiry.org or by visiting our website at pointofinquiry.org. Point of Inquiry is produced by Thomas Donnelly and recorded at the Center for Inquiry in Amherst, New York. Executive producer is Paul Kurtz. Point of Inquiry's music is written and composed by Emmy Award-winning Michael Whalen. Contributors include Tom Flynn, Lauren Becker, Benjamin Radford, Joe Nickel, David Kepsel, and Sarah Jordan. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.